You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
We want to ride along now on a journalistic mission carried out by a team of our colleagues who, like us, have been frustrated by the unfolding story of the 57,000 child migrants from Central America detained by U.S. Border Patrol police over the last 9 months. We're hearing stories of terror, barbarity, and deprivation as young people come north to try to find their parents or family members already in the U.S.
Hiding from immigration, hiding from the police, hiding from the criminals, fighting of hunger, sleep. It's a huge risk that one takes when one comes here to try and get to the United States. But you have to take risks, because if you don't take risks, you never get anywhere.
That's Nery Alfredo Montoya, a 28-year-old Honduran, speaking to reporters from the Arizona Republic newspaper. While Americans have been told that this crisis is a consequence of inaction on comprehensive immigration reform in the U.S., a team of Arizona Republic reporters traced the migrants' journey to discover that this crisis, in fact, goes way beyond U.S. immigration policies. Here's senior reporter Bob Ortega.
The notion that has been put forward by many people that Obama's immigration policies are somehow enticing children to come north simply doesn't seem to be true. It's really clear, first of all, that a significant proportion of these children, probably more than 60%, are coming north because they're fleeing violence in their home countries. And these are, we're primarily talking about Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala here. And I talked with a couple of boys in San Salvador who were both discussing whether or not they should head north themselves. One of them had to spend the last 4 months of high school hiding in his house because the gangs were after, you know, had threatened him. The only way he was able to finish high school was his teachers were sending packets home for him to work on with somebody else. And two of his other friends who were in a similar situation fled. One of them fled to the U.S., was deported back to El Salvador, and then murdered within a week of his arrival. One of the other people that I spoke with at a detention center who had just been deported back from Mexico, where she was caught on the way up, was a mother with her 19, 16, and 10-year-old daughters. And she had been living also in a neighborhood in San Salvador. About a month and a half earlier, gang members had come to her house and told her to get her two older daughters' things packed up because they were now going to be the gang's girlfriends. And she fled with her daughters. And, you know, when I spoke with her, she was desperate. She had, of course, did not have her job anymore, did not feel like they could go back to their house. That would not be safe. Said that she couldn't rely at all on local authorities because they were doing nothing and had done nothing to protect her or her family. And she had no idea where she was going to go and what she was going to do.
How much of this is a legacy of the Civil War and U.S. intervention in El Salvador, Nicaragua, the Civil War in Guatemala, in Honduras?
When you talk about the roots of violence and the kind of societal violence that you're seeing in these countries right now, that is not something that springs out of the blue. That springs out of this long, violent history that involves a 36-year-long civil war in Guatemala, a very long civil war that ran through the 80s and into the 90s in El Salvador, and the use of Honduras as a staging ground by the U.S. for the Contra war against Nicaragua, also in the 80s. So we had huge military buildups in all three of these countries with a lot of U.S. involvement and the frequent resort societally to violence as a way to control the population and to settle disputes involving the right and left politically. And when those civil wars ended, the people who were involved in a lot of the human rights abuses, who were involved in a lot of murders, remained in positions of power within the political and security structure there. As a result of those civil wars and as a result of several natural disasters that occurred, huge numbers of Central Americans fled to the U.S. in the 80s and 90s. And so there was already a significant community here. Some of those people got involved with gangs here in the U.S., the Calle 18 gang and the Mara Salvatrucha gang, which are the two dominant criminal organizations in Central America now, both have their origins actually in the Los Angeles area. When the U.S. deported large numbers of people who had criminal records and who were involved in those gangs, we did not notify the Hondurans or the Salvadorans or Guatemalans about the criminal records of the people we were deporting. So they were not prepared for them, and they were caught off guard. And that has continued to be an issue, a very sore point between the governments of those countries and the U.S.
How would you say that the U.S. concern about border security at the Mexican border has had an impact on destabilizing the conditions for some of these young people and pushing them into the hands of even more violent characters?
Well, I don't know that I would say it's been destabilizing, but it's certainly clear that one of the impacts has been to change the routes that people are using to get into the U.S. and has pushed those routes into the same routes that the drug smugglers use. In effect, what that has done has been to change the nature of who the coyotes are that are bringing these people up. The coyotes used to be people who would come from the communities that the migrants themselves were coming in and who would guide them north. Now it's become something where the drug cartels operate all of those routes, and you have to pay the drug cartels if you want to go. And if you're a coyote, you have to be either working for or paying a fee to the drug cartels every time you take someone across. What that has done is to change the nature of how this is operating now, and essentially the drug cartels essentially control the human smuggling routes into the U.S.
So that's terrifying. And in terms of your series here, what are the numbers that you've been able to determine compared to what we're hearing and seeing in the headlines in Washington and, again, the political rhetoric?
Well, so I think the issue here is not the raw numbers as much as it is the nature of what's happening. Now, if you look at the numbers the Border Patrol has provided, since October 1st, they're saying that so far 57,000 children have crossed the border unaccompanied in the last essentially 9 months, and that about 75% of those children are from Central America. That's a significant number, and it's a huge increase from last year, which was an increase from the year before, But if you look at the absolute numbers of migrants, that's really not that big. We're expecting for the year as a whole that the number of migrants is going to be something a little higher than the 450,000 last year. But that's less than half what the numbers were 5, 6, 7 years ago. So in absolute terms, if you're comparing the number of apprehensions that the Border Patrol is making now to the numbers that they were making, say, in 2006, 2007, 2008, it's far, far lower today. And that is partly as a result of increased border security, partly as a result of economic improvements in Mexico, and so on and so forth.
So numbers down, but the terror of actually making the journey is probably, you know, off the charts.
Yes, I would say that's true.
Bob Ortega, senior reporter for the Arizona Republic, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.